All right, we're going to continue with the second lecture. This one will be delivered by Oline Moctezuma from the University of Cambridge. Her work is on recipe books and kitchen gardens as sources of kitchen and medicinal knowledge and how this knowledge was passed on, maintained and changed within the household. Adequate yes. summary in both the Mexican and English context. And she will talk today about Maya recipe books and how they were appropriated and interpreted within the tradition of early 20th century American scholars.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone to be here. I think I'll just go right into it. I'm not to begin. Okay. Okay, it did work. Okay, so when looking at colonial manuscripts from Yucatan, it is central to take into account that the peninsula has suffered from the systematic destruction and displacement of its written records. Yucatan Peninsula is southeast of Mexico City, where Christian was talking about. Yeah, and the Mayas had a very strong written tradition, and they held writing as a central to their identity and ways of living. So destroying all documentary heritage was a way of controlling the territory and constructing a new Christian colony by erasing the previous history and peoples of the land. That is through memoricide, which went hand in hand with genocide. And these consistent efforts are epitomized in the Auto de Fe de Maní, which took place in 1562, a trial of supposed heretics in which people were burned together with their books, headed by the infamous Franciscan friar, Diego de Landa. This Auto de Fe was not a singular instance. Books and their scribes were continuously burned. And because of this, only four pre-Hispanic codices survived from the region, none of which remain in the peninsula. And the colonial records that survive within Yucatan today are mostly state and ecclesiastic documents. Despite such erasure, guerrilla archiving efforts led to the preservation of Maya manuscripts. For instance, Chilanquo, a religious leader, built a large library in 1567 of hand-painted hieroglyphic codices and hid them in the jungle as a central tool for his resistance movement. They were burned 2 years later when he was captured. Much less conspicuous were maestros de escuela, who were Maya scribes trained for colonial administration, and they transliterated hieroglyphic texts into Latin script and on European paper rather than keeping the manuscripts themselves. In order that, so that it was a bit more difficult to identify them just through sight. And most of these books survived spread across households, mainly in small towns at the interior of the peninsula, which was much less controlled than the few urban settlements. They were continuously expanded and transcribed over the centuries to resist colonial suppression. And here is an example of one of these documents, one of the most important registers of the process of colonization, which is known as the Xiu Chronicles, which were the family records of the Xiu family. Then they were stolen. Now they're in the U.S. But that's one of the members of the Xiu family with the document. These books included recipes, which are usually categorized as being either part of an autochthonous or native Chilambalam tradition, or the Spanish-mediated tradition of the Judío recipe books, the books of the Jew. So first, we'll go with the Chilambalam. These are some of the most famous Maya manuscripts. They're characterized by Alfredo Barrera as libraries rather than books, because they were collections of astronomic, mathematical, historical, religious, and medical texts, predominantly of Maya origin. Some of these include recipes, as is the case of Gawa, Ixil, Tecax, and Namian manuscripts. And it's important to say maybe that their names come from the towns where they were taken or the family that they were taken from. They're also written in Latin script on European paper, but in Yucatec Maya, probably by these maestros de escuela, at least in the beginning. And closely tied to the Chilambalam books, there are recipe books proper, so that they don't include all these other texts, they're just recipes. But most of them, we have no idea what their history is because they don't have this, aura as a Chilambalam book, so there's not been that much interest into them. And two examples are the Sotuta and the Mena manuscripts. All of these books, they're very difficult to date. The Maya handwriting of the Maya scribes didn't change a lot. They are very linguistically complex, and they always try to imitate a pure old style. So it's very difficult through to put all these clues together to see when they were from. So sometime between the 17th and 19th centuries. But they copied texts from the 16th century as well, and some of them state directly that they were copied from pre-Hispanic manuscripts, although that might be a bit of rhetoric. So in parallel, we have the Judio recipe books, the books of the Jew. They're written in Spanish, and they intermix Maya and Spanish medical practices. They are said to be copies of a manuscript written by a foreign physician who was called Ricardo Osado in the 17th century. Osado is said to be either a Roman or Moorish physician trained in Europe, but an expert in indigenous medicine. And like the Chilambalam books, they were copied for 200 years at least, and the copy reached print in 1834 when the peninsula was battered by the cholera morbus epidemic, and it was necessary to disseminate domestic medical knowledge due to lack of healthcare infrastructure. So all of these books come from this very small region of the Pan Maya territory. They were found and taken from towns in the northwest of the Yucatan Peninsula in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when there was this collecting frenzy that washed over the region. And most of the manuscripts were gathered by foreigners and then sent off to the United States and Europe, a few to Mexico City. And in the case of recipe books specifically, both those that were in Yucatec Maya and the Spanish recipe books, it was US Mayanist William Gates who was responsible for their displacement to Princeton University mainly, but they're also in some other US institutions. In 1914, he hired a missionary who was called Frederick Smith to be an undercover agent and try to see through small towns and hound Maya families for their manuscripts that they had been hiding for centuries. And in 1917, Gates himself would go through the region and pick up whatever was left that he could find. So yeah, the recipe books we have mostly, well, I mean, all of them come from rural households in this area. Okay, one second. So when these recipe books got back to the U.S., Gates and his students, who was Ralph Royce and Elizabeth Stewart. Ralph Royce is very well known, Elizabeth Stewart, not really. But yeah, they analyzed the recipe books, trying to reconstruct the medical system of Maya medicine men, the men, curanderos, and yerbateros. And their work continues to be the basis for the study of Maya medicine. They're extremely influential. And the most notable result was Ralph Royce's The Ethnobotany of the Maya, in which he compiled recipes from many different books into a single text. But the texts are heavily edited. They're not really just printed. He selected what he considered the most authentic and interesting versions of recipes. He filtered out European influences, then the use of non-plant materials, incantations, things like that, and ties to domestic medicine. It also intermixed the different texts to draw out, again, what he saw as the purest version of a recipe from all the different variations. And the closest to a Maya pre-Hispanic recipe. And despite all of this, the Ethnobotany is still often cited as the only printed edition of these recipe books. And again, a central in the study of Maya medicine. Okay. But Royce was not alone in this endeavor. As I mentioned, Gates and Stewart were on a quest for this systematic reconstruction as well. To do so, they had maybe elaborate system, or maybe quite simple, but yeah, they had a process to compare, purify, and superimpose Maya recipes, striving to reach the more authentic versions of the underlying structures as well. And these meticulous processes can be seen in Gates and Stewart's working papers. They translated, cut, glued recipes together in order to eliminate variation and what they called European adulterations. They divided the contents of recipes into smaller and smaller segments into their ultimate constituents, such as plant and disease names. And these were then indexed to establish relationships between manuscripts and create taxonomies, nosologies, and the relationship between plants and diseases. And then extirpating them, cutting them up, and superimposing them, they disregarded that the books were written over the span of 300 years, that all of them were from a very small area within the wider Pan Maya region, as we saw, and that it was in the domestic context that saw their survival. And furthermore, they completely ignored the recipes in Spanish. So their approach to these recipes was influenced by Middle American comparative linguistics, and Gates was a linguist after all, and it shaped scholars' assumptions about written language. Gates, Stewart, and Royce idealized the written word as an abstract object, autonomous and context independent, and in principle fixed, invariant, and stable, an object they could manipulate with scissors and glue. And the formulaic recipes were then seen as a gateway to access an abstract medical system above context-dependent performances. So in doing so, they obscure the impact of changes across time and space, as well as the interrelationship between writing, oral, and nonverbal means of transmission. This limited their insights into the multifaceted functions of writing and hindered a holistic understanding of the role of writing in the region. With this, they also avoided the bewildering variation in actual use in everyday life and the dynamics of colonialism. This perspective impeded these scholars from truly grasping the complexity, variability, and contextual richness in preserving, transmitting, and using recipes across different mediums and situations. So for these US scholars, the corpus of Maya recipes was pictured as a timeless web of part holes, perhaps in this image you can see it well, and other structural relations that when mapped, you could provide an outline of the Maya medical system, rid of, again, of any colonial influence and outside of everyday practices. And because of these aims, methods, and assumptions, the scholars took the books from the small region to stand for the whole of an entire civilization, making it stand outside of time, by amalgamating a rich history of over 300 years and decontextualizing the records from their domestic settings to reconstruct an abstract medical system. And it actually went beyond the 300 years because they would do field work and then would establish even a larger lineage trying to reconstruct also these pre-Hispanic hints within these recipe books. So, but I think this all becomes destabilized if you turn to an endemic view of writing, was it SIB? These assumptions, I mean, it really provides us with new pathways to explore these colonial recipes. So now we go to see. So ti means to write. It comes from ti, a piece of land that is cleared or prepared, and bin, to go. And the Yucatec poet Pedro Ucbe defines ti as the footprints left on the ground, the imprint of our feet in movement, marking the face of our Mother Earth. These textual expressions are not limited to the written word, nor do they belong to human beings alone. Tsib is an expansive view of writing that is shared in the Ban Maya territory, where paintings, textiles, and even the natural world, like the mosquito bites upon a person's back, are considered writing. More concretely, Tsib is defined as the presence of a pattern, cyclically recreated, but never exactly reproduced. A pattern renewed with each performance. It is changing because according to these individual performances and their shifting circumstances, but it is also enduring, recreating patterns that came before. In dwelling upon the land, we leave marks, marks that coexist and are in dialogue with others. That is, no writing stands alone, but is intimately connected with each other, the surrounding world, and the patterns of other beings, past and present. Tsib is writing as an activity rather than a set of products that unfolds across different texts and media within the same relational system. And to study these activities, it is necessary to see them as context-bound, anchored in the immediate environment, and embedded in everyday life. There are many insights we can gain when interpreting recipes according to this endemic view, which requires that we study all significant aspects of the creation and use of the text, as well as the relationships between different texts within and outside of language. And I will explore 2 points here only. The first is the interconnection between the different books and between like the Chilambalam tradition and the Judío tradition, and the destabilization of this dichotomy between the Maya and the Spanish by seeing how writing did not really accumulate knowledge, but rather renewed it. That this continuity was not static. And secondly, I reframed the books as holding domestic rather than specialized medicine, which, yes, they are always interpreted as being the medicine of medicine men, even though it doesn't have a lot of the characteristics, but we'll see. And in contextualizing them as such, I argue that it's easier to see their place within a wider writing system that transcends the page and stretches across peninsular households. Okay, so looking at the context of creation and tracing interconnections rather than dissecting recipe books blurs the lines between the Spanish recipe books, Julio's, and the Maya recipes, such as the Chilambalam books we saw. And it shows us that they were distinct performances of bodies of knowledge that intermixed, adapted, and were refashioned over time. One of the hints of this interrelationship, and I found that right before coming here, is found in one of the oldest Chilambalam books, that of Ixil. It's probably from the 17th century, but it has a lot of a lot of texts seem to be from the 16th century. And it's one of the manuscripts that is most often ignored because it has a lot of European influence. But it is important because it shows the strategies and tricks scribes used to disorient non-Maya readers, since they had to be careful about what they wrote down to avoid destruction. And in the introduction of the collection of recipes, for instance, this collection is framed as having been written by Ruy Diaz de Vivar on the slide from the Spanish epic El Mio Cid. But this figure is actually recast as a Moorish doctor who fought for the health and liberty of his people. And again, Ricardo Sal is a Moorish doctor, perhaps. This might suggest that the narrative that frames the books of the Jew, that a foreigner wrote Maya recipes, might have been a strategy to continue disseminating Yucatec recipes, making them pass as mediated by Europeans, and so less threatening. Another interesting point that we can see in the Ixil is that it contains biblical passages that draw parallels between the plight of the Jews and that of the Mayas, and it depicts the peninsula as a promised land that would be freed and returned to the Mayas, a common conception shared by rebels in the region. So further speculation, perhaps going a bit too far into it, would lead to maybe the question whether the term itself, Jew, was a nudge that it was in fact the Jews of the peninsula that held authorship of the recipes in Spanish. So it is quite enticing to formulate that even the supposedly foreign mediated material could have been written by Yucatecans themselves without external intervention, but at the end of the day, drawing these distinctions between the purely pre-Hispanic and the European is really a futile exercise. Looking within the texts themselves, as well as across them, the hybridity of the content of the recipe books is quite obvious, especially if we reread the texts rather than rely on books like the Ethnobotany of the Maya. Okay, so as we saw in Gates and Stewart's notes, the recipes were repeated and interconnected over 300 years throughout all these different recipe books. But because the US scholars discarded Spanish recipes, they didn't see that that same dynamic was happening between the Maya recipe books and the Spanish books. And a case in point comes from two manuscripts that Gates and Smith took from a town Sotuta. The Sotuta manuscript in Yucatec Maya, which was called the parent manuscript of the other Maya recipe collections because it shared the most material with the other recipe books. And Sotuta A, rooted in the Julio tradition, which is in Spanish and constantly refers to Ricardo Salo. It's the one that can be most linked to this figure. But as you can see on the slide, the books repeat many instructions. And unfortunately, I'm using Gates' translations of the Sotuta manuscript, but he was a good translator. This is an instance of the recipe for those who spit blood and for pain in the stomach. I don't know if you can see at the back, but they're almost identical. The one above, maybe I'll just read it aloud. It says, take this spreviva sitanchu, the female, not the male, which has red leaves, and the female has green ones. You have to cook them and drink them in water. And the Sotuta in Yucatec Maya, it says, the sitanchu, greenish is the leaf of the female, but the male has bright red leaves. This, then, is the female that is to be taken, boiled, and then you give the liquid to drink. Another example that's slightly different is pain in the stomach. In the Sotuta A in Spanish, says Ricardo says that manzanilla flowers applied with a satchel if it's cold, mixed with, you can't really see, If it's hot, verdolagas apply to the navel and two to the groin and on the back, in front of the stomach, and drink contra hierba in wine or the verbena, the hot water. And the Sotuta in Yucatec Maya says, whoever has the stomach pain, you look at his urine first, how it is. Then you take powdered manzanilla with a handful of the chucul, boil and mash them, and put them out over the stomach. Or else you apply a cupping glass below the navel and at the base of the spine. Or you give him the powdered cambalhau to drink in wine. Or else you take verbena and boil it and apply the juice to the stomach hot. So the only plants that seem to not be the same is just the name in the opposite language, because both Mayas and Spaniards renamed all the plants when they met them. When they came in contact with it. So chucul is verbolaga or pulsein in English, and cabalhau or h cabalhau is contra hierba, snake wort. So I think reading the text together would have bridged the practices in both languages, since the recipes that are shared between the books are also surrounded by recipes from either tradition. And additionally, within the text themselves, the dialogue between the European and Maya is evident. Sotuta A recommends different remedies according to whether the symptom is caused by an excess of heat or of cold, in harmony with Maya concepts of health. And in turn, the Sotuta in Maya calls for urinalysis according to European principles, a common instruction biosado in the Sotuta A manuscript. At the same time, this manuscript recommends a procedure rooted in Maya medicine, which was cupping. Okay. Overall, all manuscripts are to a greater or lesser extent the result of medical syncretism. They address pre-Hispanic disease concepts, which were described in the Motul Dictionary written by Spanish friars at the end of the 16th century, but together with new diseases, sometimes described as being afflictions of Christians. They also integrated local plants like ixcabalhau, canché, xixelchú, with ingredients that the Spaniards brought over, like wine, rosemary, orange, and others to be bought in the apothecary. The manuscripts also often provide synonyms of the names and plants and of plants and diseases in Yucatec Maya, because as I said, each renamed them. European instruments are also included, such as stills for medicinal extracts, and they call for processes like enemas. But they also show that cupping, bloodletting, and purging, which were practiced since pre-Hispanic times, as well as theories of disease like the ill winds and the hot cold theories, continued with Spanish influence, particularly of humoral theory. So medical concepts, ingredients, tools, and practices did not just coexist in the pages of the recipe books. They're often intermixed within the same instruction, so there is really no telling where one starts and where the other ends. In the end, recipe books were simultaneously sites for the conservation of Maya medicine, the assimilation of imported knowledge and practices, as well as spaces for innovation, or rather renewal, through their intermixture. Okay, so now to the second point, the domestic tie. Okay, so the second point is turning to the domestic context of these recipe books as part of the activities of everyday life rather than an abstract system grounded in specialized medicine, to suggest the other forms of writing that could be analyzed in conjunction. And the first clue we have is the provenance of the books. As I mentioned before, they were kept in households as family heirlooms rather than at the hands of the medicine men. The second is within the books themselves, which include household recipes, for instance, on how to remove grease stains, how to dye hair, how to cut trees to build houses, how to kill mice and catch fish. And absent, for instance, are incantations and other types of instructions to heal that the medicine men would follow. And they refer to the practices of these medicine men and doctors as a practice of others. The third is that when some of these reached print, they were titled El Libro del Judío o Medicina Doméstica, the Book of the Jew or Domestic Medicine. And this book actually also carries many of the same recipes that are in the other books, including those in Yucatec Maya. So one of the reasons behind the importance of recovering ties to domestic medicine and archiving practices is because these writings were not only shaped by changes in the immediate environment, they have also been intimately connected to surrounding patterns, and we should consider these patterns and the distributed forms of transmission in the Yucatan, the Tsi. That is, because of the plurality of forms of writing, studying recipes should not be isolated to reading the texts themselves. We should see how the same knowledge was reenacted through other means. And emphasizing recipe books as domestic productions is essential to this, because the knowledge that the recipe books contained was also kept up within the household in other forms as recipes came in and out of writing, assuring their continuity beyond the written word, which, as we have seen, was under threat across the colonial period and beyond. To this day, medical knowledge is transmitted through tsikbal, a conversation that is inserted in the intimate spaces of everyday life, through the daily routines in kitchens, which maintain the knowledge of procedures, and solares, or kitchen gardens, which keep resources and records embedded in the land of their uses. So I'll just go take a look into the latter, solares. They're particularly interesting because the content of the kitchen gardens went hand in hand with the ingredients called for in the recipe books. So what was available in the solar influenced the context of recipe books and vice versa. Maya households have historically curated a diverse set of resources to meet their needs. They hold species acclimatized by the ancestral Mayas from the humid forests in the south, including ramon, cacao, and zapote, and species incorporated during the colonial period, such as mangoes, oranges, plantains, chickens, and pigs, and they continue to expand. They're focused on self-provisioning, so they're highly diverse to ensure a year-round supply of food, medicinal resources, and materials essential for daily life. These gardens safeguard genetic diversity and traditional knowledge, supporting intergenerational transmission and maintaining a rich biodiversity. Their maintenance involves that they are continually remade each day, season, year, and generation, which requires and encourages changes in the constitution of the solar and the practices to keep it. The oldest solares remain rooted in their original identity while evolving into something new. They're both the same and transformed amidst these changes, which is perhaps a hint of how to interpret the recipe books. This is not limited to solares. The wide conception of writing shown through when residents of Sotuta, one of these places where Gates took the manuscript, the most important manuscripts from, the residents of Sotuta started a community archive of the town's foodways. And each of the people that was involved was allowed to choose a topic and the media that they wanted to document these, everything that was surrounded food, which involved creating records on an everyday basis over the course of a year. And yeah, together they collected over 4,000 images, videos, and handwritten documents. Three participants decided to create textile art pieces, cross-stitched or embroidered. Someone also restored a mural documenting women embroiderers from Sotuta. And additionally, across the year, they met to have tsikbal, this intimate conversations, to share their experiences, memories, emotions, as well as to troubleshoot problems collectively and trace pathways for the future. Okay, so here are just some examples of the types of writing that the buttress written recipes. So one of the participants, Arleni Guadalupe Jam Ewan, for instance, she started recording recipes by writing them down of everything that she was taught in the kitchen and also asking for friends and neighbors. But after a few months, she stopped because she decided that she would rather create videos together with the handwritten documents so that she could include the gestures and sensorial information as well as the words. Here's just one snippet of one of her recipes.
Tenemos calentura o vómito, algo así, mayormente nos llegan al doctor. Pero de antes, nuestros antepasados nos mostraron una forma más fácil de saber si te pasaste la sangre o es calentura normal. De esta forma nos pinchaban en forma de cruz. Cuando es en forma de cruz y la sangre sale negra, es porque es cuando hace tu sangre, pero cuando sale roja es nomás calentura.
So this kind of information on diagnosing diseases, for instance, is absent in the recipe books, other than some small instances where there are new procedures like urinalysis. Okay, so another example.
El agua sirve para los bichos. Cuando los bichos están alterados y los niños están en la cara del baño con las nariz, agarras el agua y lo pones en sus uñas esta manera, hasta que el agua entre sus uñas de sus dedos y de sus pies. Con eso ayudarás que toda la noche te va bien y los estén, no se suban los bichos, solo con un diente de agua.
Another thing that is sometimes present in the recipes, but only when it seems to be a new introduction, is where and how to get the ingredients, especially if they're from the solar. So sometimes if they're the apothecary or from the monte, the wilderness, then it will state that, but not how you would get them in the solares. So another participant, Blanca Estela Gómez Cocón, she recorded how she teaches her great-grandson how to keep a solar. And this is usually done by asking him to repeat the names of plants and their uses as he waters them. And she's also teaching him how to sow them. So here's another example.
Chile dulce, chile dulce, mamá. Chile pa comida.
She has a lot of those clips of going around the kitchen gardens, teaching him. And another is, yeah, the knowledge on how to sow them. Okay, so another instance, from the different types of writing that came out of Satuta was embroidery, and Arjimira Jimenez Canche created a cross-stitch record with a traditional technique of the process of growing corn and the underlying wisdom. So she titled it Sowing in the Hopes of a Good Harvest. And in one of the tiguales, she shared, I am sowing my past and harvesting my present. So all of these different kinds of writings worked conjointly, and they testify to the rich tapestry of transmission in Yucatan, where the day-to-day is filled with maintaining, reactivating, expanding, and renewing knowledge, practices, resources, and ways of living. Spoilers. In any case, tsuv etched upon codices was continually threatened across the colonial period, and then uprooted in the 19th and 20th centuries by scholars and collectors. This made the household into a central repository of records in the form of living beings, material resources, conversations, everyday routines, and arduous work. So in sum, in pointing out that the recipe books hold domestic knowledge rather than specialized medicine in abstract, it is easier to see how they are strongly interwoven with each other and with other types of writing, which allows us also to fill in the gaps of everything that isn't said in the recipes. And in seeing the different forms that writing can take, we're better equipped to see that there is no strict division between change and continuity, conservation and renewal. So now we go to the picture that was advertising this talk. Yes, so dividing and seeking to completely purify the colonized medicines from the colonizers is completely fruitless, as I had said, at best. But then at worst, it's what Scott Lyons argues are the genocidal implications that are always inherent in the notion of Indian identity as timeless, stable, eternal, but probably in the minds of most people still vanishing. Johannes Fabian has called this anthropology's allochronic orientation, a model where one places the other in another static time. And this is precisely the approach that the US scholars that set the tone for many studies of Maya medicine took. But they were not alone in painting the Maya peoples as standing outside of time. Their work was part of a consistent effort in the 19th and early 20th centuries to invent the Maya, as Juan Castillo Cocom has analyzed, because there really was no such unified identity in pre-Hispanic times that stretched over the whole Pan-Maya territory. The term was not employed by the peoples themselves before the Spanish invasion. And instead, the term Maya started as a political category that aspired to turn into a social identity. And it is one that has now been made into a profitable label for tourist resorts in the Riviera Maya or the Maya Train, an eco and ethnocidal mega project. So the label exploits this homogenized, exoticized identity that seems arrested in time, while destroying the livelihood and patrimony of the peoples it refers to. And this genocidal view of the Maya is timeless, at the same time that their attempts to wipe them out of their territory, if not existence, is bolstered if we continue to reinforce the exceptionalism of the written word as one of the examples, as fixed, autonomous, and the main source of authority. We continue to feed the invention of the Maya through our scholarship if we do not reevaluate the first stages of the interpretation of records and question how they added a layer to their meaning. So we'll return to Tsib. Because if we turn to Tsib, this is destabilized. And it has wider implications beyond just the interpretation of recipe books in three key dimensions. So first, Tsib sees writing as embedded and changing, but an enduring activity. It urges an understanding of writing as an activity embedded in everyday life rather than an abstract, autonomous product, challenging the written word as fixed and objective evidence that bolsters a singular, authoritative narrative. Instead, it emphasizes the cyclical and enduring quality of writing, the dynamic character of our marks upon the world. It encourages a nuanced view that considers the evolving, context-bound nature of written records, the history of which continues after their moment of creation and includes us. So it's a holistic, context-aware, and dynamic perspective on writing, secondly. On the multifaceted nature of writing and the role of the written word within larger transmission networks. It leads to breaking free from rigid categorizations, for instance, in showing us that historical texts are living entities that evolve over time, challenging the classical division in history between change and continuity, for instance. And it encourages us to embrace polyphony, to go beyond the distinctions between the autochthonous and the foreign, the human and the non-human, and the past and the present. Thirdly, because Tsib calls attention to distributed channels of transmission, it prompts a consideration of oral traditions, the shape of the land, and everyday routines as an alternative interconnected sources that we can explore together, and offers a bridge between historical and contemporary practices that does not ossify people. So Tsib calls for methodological pluralism in the end, because it urges us to explore relationships between different kinds of writings, and it also requires a reconsideration in the historical discipline of what counts as evidence. It also poses a challenge to notions such as the linearity? Well, the time is linear, and suggests that our scholarly interpretations have an effect upon records from the past. So because of this, we have an opportunity to enrich our methodologies, to enhance interdisciplinary collaboration, and thus allow us to draw insights from multiple sources and perspectives, while being self-reflexive of our own impact. So I think just to close, ultimately these fractures between the US linguist's view of writing and the endemic to the peoples that wrote the recipes is an example of the challenges and the opportunities we have if we approach our objects of study in accordance to the territories they inhabit and the worldviews that nourishes them. That's it. Thank you.